From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is astrophysicist Dr. Emma Chapman. She has written a new book called First Light, Switching on Stars at the Dawn of Time. We'll talk with Chapman about how the first stars formed, why they were so unusual, and what they can teach us about the universe today. We'll also talk with her about the immense state-of-the-art telescopes that will let us peer into the past as scientists search for the echoes and footprints of these stars and more. Dr. Emma Chapman, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you, and really exciting book that you have written here. I'd love to get I'm going to ask you for a lot of definitions during our interview, but you study the epoch of the reionization. See, I even messed up saying it. But tell
do
us
you know what I still do. It's the most terrible word, and it's the most misleading term for one of the most exciting periods in our universe.
Yes, it is. So, you know, you talk about the Big Bang and then this period of darkness, but I've also seen you call it dawn after the Big Bang. What happened then?
Well, after the Big Bang, the universe was very violent. It just contained the lightest of elements, so the elements being things like hydrogen, helium, silver, gold, all of these items are different kinds of elements. But in the early Big Bang, you could only have the very lightest ones because it was so hot and so violent that it's kind of like trying to build a Duplo or Lego tower in a room full of sugar-crazed toddlers. You can start building a little bit higher, but it's not long until the whole tower gets blown apart. So what we have in the early universe is a very dark, very boring universe that gently kind of expands and cools down. And we call this the Dark Ages because it is literally dark. There is no visible light to see it. And that lasts around 200 million years until we have the very first stars switching on. And the reason that happens is because all of this hydrogen in the universe that's just been hanging around starts to gather together through gravity. It starts to just get pulled in by each other, like each atom pulling in another atom until big clouds of gas collapse. So all the first stars are really are very lucky clouds of gas, clouds that are the right size, the right temperature to spark life into these first stars. And suddenly, you know, one lights up, another, and it's like twinkly lights all over the sky. And this is the reason I adore studying this time, because I just keep that picture in my head. And gosh, I wish I could have been there to see that happen.
You know, before we met you this morning, your enthusiasm comes right through on your book, and now meeting you in person, you've got tremendous enthusiasm. And I wanted to ask you, as a result of the Hubble Space Telescope's extraordinary body of work, we are now asking questions we didn't even think to ask 30 years ago. And both yours and my favorite photo, and I was happy to hear this, is the deep field study pictures of ancient galaxies and what we thought was inactive black space. Can you describe for us what James Webb might bring to us? I know that the Hubble is a big light bucket, and James Webb has a lot of instrumentation that's going to be able to give us even more data. Can you tell us what might be possible?
Well, the James Webb is, for anybody that hasn't heard of it, is a beast of a telescope, which has taken a very long time to conceive through NASA. It's reached a budget now of, I believe, $9 billion. And, you know, it's worth every penny, because what this is going to do is kind of be the successor to Hubble. It's slightly different in that it goes into a lower longer wavelength of light. So it's kind of like the infrared. So you might be familiar with the infrared if you've watched kind of the cop shows where they're tracing criminals, run through the fields and use infrared. So with the James Webb, we're going to be able to see, well, possibly even the deaths of the first stars. So that's my interest in it, because the first stars are very difficult to observe. But they also die, they explode in these incredibly bright supernovae. And that light is so bright that actually it might reach the James Webb telescope in a way that we can actually observe. And the James Webb, it's wonderful because it has lots of different scientific programs. For example, it's going to look at galaxy evolution. It's going to be able to peer through the dust of galaxies that are forming, because the infrared light can just break through that dust. And so we're going to be able to see within galaxies. We're going to be able to look at star formation happening. And we might even see something like exoplanet work as well. So it really is a wonderful successor, not a direct replacement for Hubble, but it's going to be the mission that we get dazzling results from for many, many years to come.
We had somebody on the show a while ago, I'm trying to think who it was, Lynn, that was telling us that in the early days of the formation of our universe, that there may have been tremendously large black holes, which typically come at the end of a star's life or a series of stars' lives. Is that possible?
Yes, this is one of the most exciting areas of study at the minute. There's been a long-standing mystery in our current universe, which is that when we look at most spiral galaxies, including our own, what we observe is evidence of black holes, but not just black holes, supermassive black holes, we call them, because they are so huge, I don't even hold a number in my head to tell you how big they are. So you're going to have to take it for granted on that. And what we can do is we can figure out how much a black hole can accrete, so eat, basically, over time, and we can project that back through the roughly 14 billion year timeline of the universe. And that it can't eat, it can't accrete enough over that time to explain how large it is. And so we just don't understand how these supermassive black holes got so large, except if in the very early universe you have the first stars forming, the first stars were very different to the stars we see today. They were much more massive, around 100 times more massive than our sun. And so if one of those dies, then you can get a very large black hole. And this could actually kind of get a jump on the growth. And that could really maybe possibly explain. But what you're talking about is something even more exciting than that, which is an idea called direct collapse black holes. And this can happen, we think, because you might be able to form first stars, which are even up to limits of around 1,000 times the mass of our sun. And what happens here is the gas cloud is so large that it starts collapsing into a star. It kind of forms a protostar. So that's the very, very beginnings when fusion is kind of sparked. But it's so heavy, there's so much mass that it just keeps on collapsing. So whereas fusion in a traditional star would hold up that collapse for, say, 9 billion years if you're the sun, only 1 million years if you're a first star, just keeps on collapsing. And so it is like it sounds, it's a direct collapse black hole. And that really would get a jump on growth, and it really would explain these supermassive black holes. So it's very exciting to think that the black holes that we see at the center of our galaxy could actually be fossils from the very first stars. And I really love that idea. How are we going to observe these things? It's probably going to be through gravitational waves with a space-based gravitational wave telescope. That's some decades in the future, but that gives me plenty of time to do some lovely theory and simulations and get very excited about it.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Emma Chapman. She has written a new book called First Light, Switching on Stars at the Dawn of Time. And I have to say, we're speaking with Dr. Chapman via Zoom, and so we can see her, although our listeners can't. But I wish our listeners could see the excitement that we're seeing, not only from what she's saying, but just to see her, how excited she is about what she's talking about. And which I think is so wonderful, and it takes someone like you, Emma, to spread on that palpable excitement about the work that you do. And so I'm wondering, how did you get into this work? And, you know, at what point did you just say, this is my life's work, this is what I have to do, this is so important?
Really interesting question, and thank you for your kind words. My enthusiasm comes from being a complete child and not being afraid of asking stupid questions.
I love it.
And so I just get excited by the next stupid question that comes into my head about this field. I came into this field completely by accident. Even in the earliest times, like 15 years old, I wanted to be an Egyptologist. I picked up a book on special relativity. Mind was blown. Changed everything and went to study physics at university. And then when I started my PhD in astrophysics, I was given a project on dark energy. If your listeners aren't familiar with this, it's a very mysterious component of our universe, which looks like it's kind of accelerated the expansion of the universe. Oh, I got given that project. So I was just like, oh, I'm just not very interested. You know, it's, I just don't feel it. And so my supervisor said, well, I do have this other little project. It's about the first stars. I was like, oh, I've never heard about this. It's not something you think about. You think about the heritage of the human race. You look back in, you know, all of these kind of who do you think you are programs and doing DNA kits, but you don't think about the heritage of the stars and the ancestry of these objects. So I fell into this work, and I have to say that at first I was quite disappointed because I thought, oh, I'm going to get to go to Hawaii. I'm going to get to download images from Hubble. And then I was sent to the flatlands of the Netherlands to get rained on using a radio telescope in the mud. But you know what? That's why I fell in love with it. Because after about a month of using these instruments, I realized that using almost the simplest of technology, most down-to-earth technology, you get 13-billion-year-old images of this time. And that continues to blow my mind today. And it is why I selfishly do outreach like this, because every time I talk about it, I remind myself just how cool it is.
Oh, I love that explanation. Well, since you're a fan of dumb questions, I'm going to ask one. Or maybe it's not dumb. I've never heard the word accrete before. You talked about how black holes eat up or accrete. Is that, and I tried to look it up, is that sort of the synonym or the antonym of secrete?
Yes, I guess it is, actually. I've never thought about that. Yeah, so you can kind of think about a vinyl record and how the needle tracks inwards on a vinyl record. And this is what accretion is around an astronomical object. And so with a black hole, what happens is all of the dust that's around a galaxy, so by dust we just mean loads of elements that's in tiny little bits, and it just, through gravity, doesn't get sucked in, as a lot of people say, like black holes suck. They don't. they accrete, so they spin around in ever smaller circles until they circle the drain and poof, gone forever.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Emma Chapman. She's written First Light, Switching on Stars at the Dawn of Time. Dr. Chapman, you mentioned in your book, you talk about it in your book, about how curious you were as a child and about your interest in archaeology, specifically King Tut's tomb in Egypt. And I've never met a child that wasn't curious, and then something happens to some kids that as they get older, they don't ask as many questions, they don't act as curious. What can we do as parents, as grandparents, to instill that sense of wonder and curiosity that will encourage them to keep asking questions?
I think the best advice is to keep answering questions. because that curiosity is naturally born in children. And I think it starts to wane because we simply get busy in our lives and we start to say, oh, for goodness sake, I'm just, I don't know. But what we can do now is look it up. We can ask our, I don't want to say the word because it activates them, our smart people, smart speakers. We could ask them the answers and then talk to our children about it. There's documentaries about everything now on various platforms. And so, yeah, I think it is about telling them that there are no stupid questions. So I said, you know, I'm a fan of asking them. But what I mean is that I have no fear of asking any question. And that's what we need to keep alive in our children. So keep on answering questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And Neil deGrasse Tyson talks about jumping in mud puddles and trying to catch snowflakes in his mouth and spinning around in chairs and boardrooms when he's supposed to be paying attention. So he's got a lot of kid in him. And we need to figure out a way to take Neil and to take you and to replicate that. We know from your book, you write in your book, that the signature of first stars has a wavelength of about 2 meters. Now, there's a lot of stuff in the universe, including cell phones, TV shows, and cool science radio that could interfere with and make it hard for you to read these. How do we get past, how do you get past all this interference?
With very clever statistical methods, really, which sounds very boring, which is why I do outreach to remind myself why I sit down every day and do very complex statistical methods. The four, what we call them, is foregrounds. So that just means everything in the way of the signal that we want to detect. And so you're absolutely right. There's a heck of a lot in the way. It's about 10,000 times the size of our signal, all of this noise. That's huge. It really is trying to listen to the most quietest of signals. But what's really interesting, and the way we can separate them out, is that they sound very different when we look at the signals. So whereas all of the very noisy stuff in our universe, there's so much of it, it's all clashing together, it sounds really dissonant. It sounds really, you know, like a heavy metal band, kind of like, ah! Whereas the first star signal, it's very calm. It's from a single period in our universe where not much was going on. And so you have a very kind of calm signal. So your classical music. So it's almost like you're listening to cool science radio and a pirate radio station comes in with heavy metal. Even though you've got those overlapping signals, your brain is able to kind of separate them out, not perfectly, but understand that there are two different signals going on there. And so with lots of clever machinery, we can tweak it out. We can just keep going. And this takes a long time. We've been at it for about 10 years. With the current generation telescopes, you need to observe for a long time. About 6 years of data, and then it's taken us several years to really dig down and try and analyze that.
Mm-hmm. Emma, I wanted to ask you about telescopes, sort of an umbrella view of the telescopes. You know, we've talked about the Hubble Space Telescope, which you love, the James Webb Space Telescope that you can't wait for. And by the way, when is that coming online? I know there have been a lot of delays.
It's being launched in the fall of this year, oh, wow. We hope. So there's been yes, a lot of delays, the latest one being the pandemic, of course. But we can't see why it won't go up in the fall, which is just super exciting.
Yes. And, you know, we like to lay claim a little bit to the James Webb Space Telescope because a lot of the components, I'm not sure if the heat shield, I have been worked on in Utah and over the years. And so, you know, we're going to lay claim to it because why not?
No, as you should. It's the most incredible piece of technology. You know, this sun shield, it comes out from being folded into this tiny little package. It's like unfolding your tent in the wilderness, you know, except the wilderness is space and it's too far to get someone to help. It really is the most incredible technology. I can't think of something that compares to it, actually.
Well, we've got James Webb and we've got We've got the Hubble and other big projects, not telescopes, but the Hadron Collider and International Space Station and all of that. But another large project, which is coming to us all, is the Square Kilometer Array Project. Can you describe what that is?
Okay, so this is an upcoming radio telescope. A radio telescope looks very different to what you will know as an optical telescope, either, you know, the kind of one that you would set up in your backyard or the Hubble Space Telescope in space. A radio telescope really looks like the antennas you used to put on your roof to get to the TV. And the technology hasn't changed that much. There's not any special metal involved. And the latest antennas that we're building for the Square Kilometer Array look kind of like Christmas trees. If you can just imagine a Christmas tree made of lots of different wire prongs, that's what an antenna looks like. But what we're doing is we're putting 130,000 of them in the Western Australian desert, and joining them all up. And therefore, what we can do is we can listen to that really quiet signal with gigantic ears. And so what we'll be able to do is hopefully see this first star signal, really open the tomb door on this hidden time 13 billion years ago, and fill in what is a missing billion years in our cosmological timeline.
And I believe that one of the challenges is all the data that it is going to produce. It's capturing that data, holding on to it, analyzing it, and those sorts of things. I was fascinated a couple years ago. We spoke with Dr. George Church over at Harvard University. He runs the genetics group over there. And he's working on a way to store data in biological cells. And there's a lot of people working on that right now. It's something that might help out, but can you talk about some of the data requirements for the Square Kilometer Array?
Yeah, the Square Kilometer Array is going to be one of the largest infrastructures in the world. So whereas the antennas are kind of basic technology, the stuff that we need to join all of these things up and the data rate that comes out of them is going to be huge. For example, the fiber optic cable that joins it all together could wrap twice around the Earth. And then when you have the data coming in from the sky, so if you imagine trying to download an episode of whatever you're into right now, you know, that has to buffer and come down. What we're doing is downloading the data from the entire sky, the entire southern hemisphere. And for example, every year, the volume of data stored by the SKA would fill over a million laptops. So we're using analogies that are even difficult to imagine. That's the problem. Even the analogies are really large. So we're getting petabytes of data. And what that is doing, interestingly, is really driving development. For example, this data rate explodes hard drives. And so we're working with computer chip companies to create cooling drives that can cool these hard drives quick enough that we can actually store this data. And in fact, we can't store it all. We have to make some very difficult decisions and delete it as we go, which is a painful decision. And we have to get very good at deciding what is good data and what is bad data. And that's what we're learning right now with the current telescopes, which you kind of call pathfinders, so test sites for the Square Kilometer Array.
Well, Dr. Emma Chapman is our guest, and her new book is First Light, Switching on Stars at the Dawn of Time. And if you as a listener out there have thought, wow, I'm understanding what she's talking about, then you should read this book because you do, just the same as you gave the example of the toddler and the Legos, this is the kind of stories that you tell in your book. And so it makes it very accessible, and hopefully it makes your readers and our listeners as excited about learning more as you are about the work that you do.
Thank you. I wrote it so my mum could understand what I do. So I really hope that everybody enjoys it.
Emma, will you come back and join us again?
Oh my goodness, yes. Anytime.
Love to have you back.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us. Bye now. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us. Give us a 5. and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.